Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas. Today's special guest is Daniel Doherty. We're going to be talking today about credentialing and accreditation. Daniel's got 30 years experience of coaching and business coaching. Daniel returned to the UK from South Africa in 2005 to complete a PhD to teach and research in higher education institutions. In 2006, Daniel founded the Critical Coaching Research Group, which he continues to lead to this day. His preferred research idiom is narrative practice. In the past 2 years, he has authored two satirical novels set in the coaching world and is in the process of writing a series of plays for voices. Daniel, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Simon. Good to see you.
Good. So you sent me a paper and I got very interested in it about credentialing, and both you and I have had some questions around quality control, credentialing, accreditation. So where should we begin this conversation?
Well, I think everything you just said there, it's all entangled, to use one of your favorite words. And it is really entangled in my mind and in many other people's. I think we might start in what's in the mind of somebody who approaches this world. Now, we're thinking in particular about accreditation and coaching, or credentialing and accreditation and coaching, as opposed to something else. In the world of engineering or law or medicine or teaching, it's relatively straightforward.
Yeah.
You know what the institution is, you know what the requirements are, you know what the various degrees of credentialing are. And if you don't get through those hoops, you don't practice.
Yeah.
In the world of coaching, it's far messier than that. And you actually have the choice not to engage at all.
That's right. And I mean, in my experience, I remember the famous paper in the early 2000s called The Wild West of Coaching. And there was a big shout out that we need to regulate this profession. We need to accredit it. And then we got this explosion of accrediting bodies who were self-appointed bodies. And I think the Wild West has moved into the, I think you write about this, about the Wild West is now in the accrediting bodies, not in the practitioners.
I think it's the Wild West of accrediting bodies. And it's also the Wild West of coach training, of coach skilling.
Yeah.
But I think now that the money seems to be made in saying, convince coaches that they need skilling, that they need training, that they need badges, and pull them towards you. Because I notice more and more people that would set themselves up as being powerful in the field, if not gurus, most of their time is spent in skilling of coaches rather than direct coaching themselves. I mean, without naming names, I remember talking to a luminary in the field 10, 12 years ago, actually, in Dublin, and saying to him, how's your coaching going? And he looked at me really strangely. He said, what? I said, well, you know, how's your coaching coming on? Should we have a kind of coach-to-coach conversation? He said, I don't do that. That's not what I do.
Yeah,
I was stunned. That seemed just, you know, normal to him. And there's no reason why such people should be spending any time at all practicing the thing that they preach. But on the other hand, it might just help.
I mean, it certainly helps me. I love the movement between client work, training and development work, and theoretical study, and between sort of practice, theory, but being with clients in different settings is just so informative. I mean, I learn a lot from supervision as well. It's interesting, you get fed by these different areas, but moving between those places, I think, is very important. You did some research and you sent me this paper on different perceptions of accreditation and how people take up different relationships to credentialing. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think, first of all, to make the distinction between credentialing and accreditation. Mm-hmm. I think most people know what accreditation is, whether or not you accept that those accreditations are based on anything at all. They're systematized, they're set up, they're saying, here's some kind of competency grid, yeah, and we'll test you against those, that competency grid, to various degrees, mm-hmm, of maturity. Yeah, so we kind of know what an accreditation is, and a badge comes out of it. Credentialing is, I think it's slippier. It may include accreditation, it may not.
Yeah.
And there can be someone who collects, you know, all the badges in the world, doesn't make them a great coach. And there could be someone who hasn't got a badge in the world and wouldn't know a tool or technique if they tripped over them, but has amazing empathic skills and ability to move with the client, who will have business for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think different people have very different orientations to the extent to which they need or want to have these accreditations.
Yeah, yeah.
If we stick, first of all, with accreditations as opposed to credentials.
Yeah, and you've mapped that out. So talk us through your mapping of that.
So what I identified is 8 different categories of accreditation consumer. This began when I was, I found myself teaching critical consumerism at Exeter University. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I wanted to teach critical consumerism, but I was told that was a module I'd be teaching that year. And I actually was really interested in the extent to which marketers can capture markets where the markets seem fairly nebulous. And so I began to look at what happens in the pre-purchase stage when people are looking around deciding what it is they might buy and whether or not they might buy, and discovered 8 different categories. One was the enthusiasts.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, coaching is great. I've just been coached, or I just coached someone. It's the greatest thing in the world. Can't wait to get after it. And I want to be the best coach that can ever be. Mm-hmm. And if there's qualifications, let me go for it. There's the compliers who are a bit different, who want to do the right thing. Yeah. You've got to believe there's rules out there and they're telling me, what are the rules? How do I become compliant? And how can I ensure that I'm not deviating from purpose? They're highly conscientious individuals. People that I describe as the susceptibles, and these are people who are highly susceptible to marketing hype. Mm-hmm. And they see on Facebook, come to a free weekend on making you the best coach you could ever be, come on our course, decide if you like it, give us all your redundancy money. You don't say that, but that's kind of behind it.
Yeah, yeah.
And in 2 years' time, you'll have a speedboat, you'll have a house in Mauritius,
yeah,
and you'll have your own jet plane, and life will be fine. So susceptible to the kind of the marketing clothes. Identified the pragmatists, and they're not too bothered actually about which accreditation they follow or which membership they follow. They're like, what's the minimum I need to have if a customer, such a major corporate player, or say the NHS, say, are you a member of a coaching body?
Yeah.
They say, yes, I am. And they say, what are you qualified? What level are you qualified to? And they say, I'm qualified to practitioner level. And the buyer says, fine, you know, carry on.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll go for the minimum. There's actually, it's a lot of the next category, which are the procrastinators. Mm-hmm. So much choice out there.
Yeah.
And in my role as teaching in universities, and also we're running a coaching body, there's people come to me going, what should I do? Which one should I choose? You know, there's 9 to go at. I've looked at all of them. I've read all this stuff. What do you think? And I'm going, honestly, I don't know. I really don't know. I said, but if in doubt, keep procrastinating. And they're going, no, I've got to land on something. But they're saying, I know there's a new one coming out next year. It's like, you know, iPhone 12 is just about to come. Should I wait for it, or should I get an iPhone 11? Or
yeah, yeah, yeah.
That kind of talk going on. So the procrastinators. Now, there's the agnostics, very interesting category, who are saying, I've got a very well-established business already. I've got a good business head. I've got a fabulous network. I'm stepping out of a major corporate role. I'm going coaching. And mm-hmm. I don't think I need any of this stuff. And I'll grow a business. And in fact, I really question why this stuff's around at all, because it might be contaminating the reputation of coaches who are naturally good. Identified the ideologues, and the ideologues tend to be very high-minded about coaching and say it all began in a very emancipatory way. There was a moral purpose and an evangelizing purpose behind coaching. And we don't want that contaminated by marketization or professionalization. So they will be pushing very hard at what they see as the as contamination or perversion. And they'll be asking those critical questions a lot of the time. And the final category is a bit more fluid. As I was calling inquirers, the people who are, they're restless, they're driven. Yeah. I mean, if think about Eric DeHaan's bit, I coach, I doubt, therefore I coach. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The people that carry a lot of doubt, and people who doubt can be make great coaches. These coaching themselves a form of research or inquiry. So they ask questions of their clients, they ask questions of themselves. Mm-hmm. And they're very interested, not necessarily in novelty, but ideas, concepts that really, really cause them to dig deep and to say, what is this practice about? And also to say ethically, what's its purpose and where is it headed? So, and they're a group that would say we're interested in credentials, not accreditation. Mm-hmm. Although I may do an accreditation to get a set of skills, could be helpful. But when I've asked them, what do you mean by a credential? It gets very vague. And it's like a basket of stuff an individual might have that another individual wouldn't have, that the market might want to buy. There may be other categories too, but they're the eight that I've come across.
And what about yourself? You've gone through different accrediting bodies and credentialing bodies, haven't you?
I have. Part of it was immersive inquiry. Part of it was that David Meganson, who's now retired, he and I were serving on a professional body which had set up its own accreditation pathway. Mm-hmm. He was proselytizing the accreditation pathway without stepping in on it himself. Mm-hmm. He said to me one summer, why don't we both do this? And I said, to see what it's like. And because we'd been very critical of the competency grid.
Yes.
And it seemed a good way to be critical of that was to step inside of the competency grid. At that point, it had like 120 different categories of competence to 120 to find evidence of in your own practice. Anyway, that's changed. But I found that I followed that pathway. David didn't, to my chagrin. But there we are. And found myself accredited. There was one point at which the body said, now you're accredited, you're going to be one of our greatest fans and one of our greatest supporters. And I said, no, and I don't think that's the deal. You know, I've got your badge, but I'm allowed to ask questions about it.
Yes.
And about the basis of it. And they found that very perturbing. Mm. I said, how can you live with both of those things in your mind? Has it been useful for me? Not in the slightest, in the sense of out there in the market. Has anyone asked me for it?
No,
have I told anyone about it now and again? And they go, could we talk about something more interesting? You know, why are you telling me about this badge you've got?
And do you think it gives any level of quality control? Do you think it has any impact on quality control of coaches? Any regulating kind of function?
For some types of coach, yes. For the compliers, most definitely. Probably for the enthusiasts, it has. Mm-hmm. Level of quality control. Is that quality control measurable? Not at all. When I've asked the bodies about this, said everyone when he signs up to join our body, they sign saying we will comply with the code of ethics and the code of conduct.
And
you're satisfied that therefore they will? And they go, oh, they've signed that, therefore they will. Now, the incident of people reported by clients to these bodies as being in violation of the rules and regs. I don't have a figure on this, but it's minute. It's really, really tiny. And that in itself is interesting, but the bodies would suggest that if you don't have membership and if you don't have a good level of accreditation, you're likely to be vulnerable to challenged by clients for unprofessional behavior or unprofessional conduct or whatever it is. And that code of conduct has grown through the years to be looking very draconian.
Yes, yeah, sure. No, I agree. Yeah. I agree.
But I really question, you know, I noticed that you had it appended to your own ANC. It's not a bad scene. It's saying there is a global code of conduct that we would ask coaches to comply with, but it's not global. I mean, coaching is different across the world. And it's no, but most of all, I think to answer your real question, it's not that enforceable. But you can socially construct it to look as though it is.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's raising awareness. You're paying attention to those issues as a trainer or a training body just on your horizon. If you're part of a wider body of practice, that's kind of what I was doing, signifying that, you know, we haven't forgotten about this. It's just there, you know. I train coaches, as you know. I have my own network coaching business, and you're on the course at the moment. And, we have 300 coaches trained across the globe. I have no way of regulating what they do or what they practice under the name of analyst network coaching. I mean, if someone comes back to me and reports some bad practice, and I can personally kind of inquire and stuff, but that doesn't happen so far. So you train people and you try and encourage them to work in an ethical way and kind of continue to develop their practice. We offer webinars and I mean, for me, quality control has always been about the quality of the theory and the practice and peer supervision, the learning from each other. Creating a learning community is kind of what enhances coaching practice for me. And that's what binds my work together mainly.
And there'll be a community who have a shared understanding what those implicit standards might be. They're not always explicit at all, but they have an idea of where the line might be. And it could be in an informal conversation or in, you know, more formal supervisory conversation of going, are you really sure that's the way to be going with that client? You know, what was in your head when you asked that question you mentioned to me?
Yeah.
And I just have a sense of that myself. I know when that works really well for me, and I know who I go to when I have a real dilemma. And I think it's a troubling world, coaching. You're going to have real questions about a direction you might have sent a client in or something. You nodded and said, yeah. So to have someone to talk that through and work with is very important.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think about it in terms of, I mean, I think these kind of regulative bodies are, they're kind of contractual bodies. And I think about covenantal ways of working rather than contractual ways of working, rather than kind of a written statements. It's really about kind of having a covenant that you kind of really want to work in good practice. And to do that, you do go to a supervision, to a peer, to share stuff, and you do wrestle with the tensions. We don't hide the tensions. We encourage them to be wrestled with in our workshops and in our webinars, that, you know, we explore those tensions and that's part of the work, because that's what you're going to be doing with clients as well.
Exactly. So that's the kind of work that you're doing. It's a parallel process to what's happening inside of the client. And if you can't do that work on yourself, how can you possibly expect the client to be engaging in that degree of introspection and, you know, of reflection on what it is they themselves are doing? There's also, I mean, there have been, over the period that I've been looking at, there have been all kinds of pushes to say, we'll get ourselves properly regulated. Mm-hmm. We'll go to the EU, or we'll go to the UK government, or we'll go to the Singapore Stock Exchange, or whatever it is you want to go to, and say, please regulate us.
Yeah.
And these governmental bodies, they really don't want it. They're like, we understand that, you know, there's many cowboys in your business. That's the word they'll use, yeah. And charlatans. But don't ask us to go regulating them, because it's a morass. You know, it's really difficult. It's very similar to homeopathy. Mm. Yeah. It was like people say to the government, help us regulate homeopaths. They're going, well, it's so fuzzy. How do we know? That some of them could be very good. Some of them could be terrible. Some of their pills could work. Some of them might not.
Yeah. Well, they've had the same struggle in counselling supervision in Ireland and in France, and there's a massive battle going on in France around the regulation of psychologists, because psychoanalysts say the minute you regulate, they're saying things. It's like the ICF coaching, that they say what your job is to do is to coach individuals to raise their potential. And I'm immediately kind of struck, well, that's not my job as a coach. I do something different with people. I'm not focused on kind of making them high performance individuals. And And in France, they're saying, like, your psychologist's job is to do this, 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 and this. And psychoanalysts say, we don't do that. We do something very different, you know. And immediately you get these kind of regulation bodies. It kind of limits the field. It constrains the field to the most dominant group in the field. And that's what's happened in coaching quite a bit. People think that coaching is this, this, and this, because the ICF, the biggest body, say it's this, this, and this.
Are you aware that the ICF has now gone planetary?
Has it?
Yeah. Well, we can laugh about this. I mean, part of me is what people say, that's fantastic that the ICF are sounding so eco. And, you know, we embrace ecological change, we embrace social change, we embrace economic change, we're a sustainable outfit, and we're here to promote the sustainability of this precious planet of ours through coaching.
Yeah.
And I read that the other week and my jaw dropped a bit. And I thought, well, this is either a fantastic piece of greenwashing, you know, a bit of woke capitalism, or else they actually do mean it. And the Association for Coaching are saying that we're taking climate change very seriously. The MCC are saying the same. And the kind of outliers in those bodies are saying, here's where you must focus. But have they taken the step that you and others have taken to say, this requires a fundamentally different networked approach towards the coaching you're doing?
Yeah.
And understanding ecosystems and subsystems. It's not just enough to say, I believe in saving the planet.
Sure.
Let's get on with improving your performance this year against your KPIs.
Sure. I mean, I have huge problems. In my coaching and mentoring textbook, I kind of I challenge these organizations, and I'm not trained and accredited by any of these bodies. And I sold out a bit. When I started to take analytics network coaching into the US, people said to me, the ICF's really big and you have to be accredited by it. You have to kind of give credit points for ICF coaches or you won't recruit anybody. And a bit like you, I did some action research. I thought, let's go through the process and see what it feels like and see what it is. And the process it's a money-making machine. Basically, I pay someone because I'm not good at filling out forms. I pay someone to fill out a form for me and they fill out a form. And I pay the ICF a lump sum. And they give me a badge of accrediting people to be CCU or to get points to maintain their ICF accreditation. They've never seen my course. They don't know if I've been a complete charlatan. And it does feel like you're part of just a money.
Really? Is that true?
Yeah, wow. Absolutely true. Mm. I filled out forms, paid them some money, and they give me a stamp to say I can give out so many CC points for the hours I teach. No one's ever checked anything about my body. And that seems kind of it reveals a real gap in the ethics of the organization.
This, for me, this CPD, continuous professional development, personal development, continuous pernicious development, whatever it stands for, a different thing in different people's minds. But now that has become, it's become measured in ours. So this would be alongside of Bob Garvey's idea of neo-feudalism. Mm-hmm. Coming in quite strongly into coaching, where things are measured, where people are measured.
Yeah.
And, well, I've even noticed with my own critical coaching group of people saying, will you give me a CPD certificate?
Yeah.
I said, no, I'll write you a letter saying, here's why I think you've contributed to the group.
Yeah.
And I said,
well,
that's really nice. And can I put down how many hours? It's up to you. You talk to anyone you like about the hours you spent here.
Yeah.
But it's not time served. It's about the quality of what it is you're getting out of that piece of learning. The CPD thing has become a requirement for renewal of accreditation.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a marketing game. It's like a... You know, you pay first to get accredited, and then you have to maintain your accreditation by getting so many points, and then you have 10 courses which are accredited by them. So the course trainers, they pay money to the body, and it goes round and round in circles. And I recall being a counselor when I did my counselor training, and I even then I kind of thought, well, actually, coaches and counselors, basically, if you're an obsessive compulsive person, you're going to do very well because you're going to tick all the hours, you're going to fit all the boxes, you're going to be resilient, you're going to be one of these compliers, and they're the ones who are going to get the to the top of the coaching profession in terms of accreditation. Where someone who's very creative and good at the job, they're not going to fill out all these forms and tick all these boxes and do all these arrows, and it actually doesn't show any quality control. It is just a numbers game.
We also, it might be a good point to think then about what the business schools are up to in all of this. In some ways, they would say we're apart from all of this shenanigans, but they're not.
No.
And in fact, I've come across people who they're credential hunting now, not just through professional bodies, but also through the business school. And there's one person who gave me permission to publicize her post-nominals, letter after the name. And there were 72 of them, 72. And I've been looking at LinkedIn on the ribbons that people have behind their name, the SQ7 and the 75. Okay. No human being knows what these things are, except someone who's into all of that. But I don't stop anyone from saying that's the pursuit that they want to take and they want to. And I also know that many people from CPD, whatever it might be, will learn stuff and will want to learn and will be restless and hungry to learn.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But that's not their motivation. But for others, it's give me the points. Yeah. I just wanted to just to be effectively interrupting you once more. I looked at some CPD stuff and it was saying to get your points, it was like 10 hours of going on courses, 15 hours of reflective practice. You didn't have to show anyone. About 100 hours of reading or watching podcasts, which is completely and utterly unmeasured, So you could say, I've read Simon Weston's Critical Coaching 10 times, and I go, yes, well done. You must know it by heart. You pass through. And how's your reflective practice going? Oh, it's going great. It's going fine. So even when there are people collecting these numbers, the quality control of that is very tiny.
Yeah, and the other thing happens with this is this parallel process again. So when you become part of target culture, audit culture, control by numbers, however you want to say it, you actually bring that into the coaching and you can see people kind of setting targets for the clients. They set goals for the clients and the HR department wants to measure those goals and you become part of, it's like not separate from the actual work you're doing with the client. And then and it's becomes really part of a huge kind of surveillance culture as well,
Yeah, so the coach themselves become complicit, they become compromised, they become entangled.
Absolutely.
With the client's own requirement. Or, in my day, there used to be some kind of strange stuff about a client saying it's coming up to the end of April, end of March, and we've got £2,000 left in our coaching budget. How about it? Come and give us a dose or we'll pay you. You know what I mean? Like it was, it was fairly benign, and they were gaming the system, and you were happy to game that along to some extent. But if you're saying to the client, what do you have to do? What numbers do you have to show? And I'll work with you to get those numbers. That's a very pernicious thing, really.
So we have a message. We have a shared message, I think, to coaches to be critical, to think critically about these issues. Don't just be compliant box tickers.
Yeah, completely. And I'd say don't dive into this until you've had a really long, hard look at it.
Yeah.
And I'd certainly say, my concern in all of this, it's not for the agnostics, it's not for the ideologue, it's not for the inquirers. My values really start to twitch when I see people putting a lot of their own hard-earned money, and very often just redundancy money and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Into a marketing pitch.
Yeah.
It's complete nonsense, and they end up finding themselves, trapped in a monkey cage. They really can't get out of. It's there, and it's and they have to kind of believe it. One stage that the three cherries, the four cherries, the five cherries will come up.
Yeah,
and they will get the money that they were promised. I just feel for those people, and this shouldn't be going on.
No, it's playing on people's vulnerabilities. I actually went, I saw this in the Financial Times, an advert for one of these schemes, and I actually went to investigate. I was interested. This person was saying, you can earn $300,000 a year doing coaching. We'll train you in 6 months. And so I went to find out. And after the guy talked to me, he said, I really want you to be my trainer. I want you to be my trainer because I don't know anything about coaching, but... I've got a basic, and he was taking £100,000 off people.
Yeah.
And saying, you work in a bank, so you've got a bank network, you're going to get this amount of money, this return on business. it was a complete scam, really big scam, and the guy didn't know anything. So yeah, beware coaches, beware retirees of jumping on that bandwagon. Listen, we're coming to an end. I've got to ask you two questions I ask all my guests.
Carry on.
It's about how to live a good life and how to create a good society. Do you have any advice for our listeners?
To how to live a good life, I would say look askance at what's around you. Mm-hmm. Ask some critical questions, not nihilistic questions that tear everything down around you, but ask yourself, why is someone persuading me so hard that this is the way the life is? Mm-hmm. And perhaps it's not. So it would be, take a critical eye and also at some level to see the absurdity in life, the way many of us live it nowadays. Where is the absurd? And either not take that too seriously or take it very seriously indeed and call the absurdity out for what it is. Good society, my goodness, that's trickier. I would say, live in a smallish town of under 20,000 people. Get to know as many of them as you possibly can. And I'm not entirely joking about this. We live in a small town, and in so many ways, it's just great because the norms are there. You know, you kind of know them, and you're not going to be treating people badly because you'll see them at the bus stop or in the butcher's the next day. So. And I just have to believe, and you know, the optimist in believes that we do. We do have some sense of shared moral compass.
Yeah.
And listen to that and notice it.
Yeah.
And if the guilt or the shame comes up, it's coming up for a reason. Say, why might this be?
Good. Well, listen, Dan, you keep up your good work. It's lovely talking with you.
And you.
Just want to share with listeners that if you're interested in joining a critical coaching group, then Dan runs a very wonderful group. I've been part of it for a good few years now. Get in touch with me and I can put you in touch with Dan. And if you want to go on a coach training course, which has a critical edge to it, we're running one in May online. Get in touch. Thanks, Dan. Take care.
Thanks a lot, Simon.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.